Good morning. This is Focus 580, our morning talk program, hour number two. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producers, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, Jason Croft is at the controls. In this hour, we reach into the archives for a program that we first broadcast August 4th of 2006. So as you listen this hour, do keep in mind that we'll not be taking calls. In this first hour of our program, we'll be talking with someone who, over time now, going back some years, has caused a lot of people to think carefully about what they eat, what it means for them and their health, but also what it means for the health of the planet. And our guest is Frances Moore LaPaix. She published a book back in 1971 titled Diet for a Small Planet. And here's how some of what she wrote there in the book. She writes, "When your mother told you to eat everything on your plate because people were starving in India, you thought it was pretty silly. You knew the family dog would be the only one affected by what you did or didn't waste. Since then, you've probably continued to think that making any sort of ethical issue about eating is absurd. But eating habits can have meaning, a meaning that not only feels closer to you than an abstract ethic, but brings you pleasure, too." She made an argument back then that some people thought was kind of radical. Certainly the folks in the beef industry didn't care much for it. Said that we could feed more people by feeding them directly the grain that we were feeding to animals to produce meat. She also made the argument that hunger, as an international problem, was really not so much about scarcity, it was about politics and economics. That book certainly found an audience. There are people who still read it, and it has sold over time several million copies. She has gone on to do some other things since. She published that book in 1971. Her most recent book is titled Democracy's Edge, and it is about citizen activism, something that she has become increasingly involved with over the last few years. Let me give you just a little bit more in the way of background. She and her daughter, Anna, lead the Cambridge-based Small Planet Institute. That's a network for research in popular education where they're interested in bringing democracy to life. Back in 1975, with Joseph Collins, she launched the California-based Institute for Food and Development Policy, which is known sort of informally as Food First. And it continues to do that kind of work and to shape the way people think about the root causes of hunger and poverty. In 1990, she co-founded the Center for Living Democracy, which was an initiative to help accelerate the speed of democratic innovations. She's contributed, in addition to her books, and she's the author or co-author of 15, she's contributed articles and opinion pieces to many publications. She's been widely interviewed. She has received 17 honorary doctorates. And in 1987, she became the fourth American to receive the Right Livelihood Award, sometimes called the Alternative Nobel Prize. And she is joining us this morning by telephone, and we'll be talking about some of what you will find in her recent book, Democracy's Edge, Choosing to Save Our Country by Bringing Democracy to Life. It is published by Jossie Bass. It's out now in the bookstore. Ms. LaPaix, hello.
Hello.
Thanks for talking with us.
Well, thank you for that lovely introduction.
Well, I hope that people didn't feel like I was going on forever, but I wanted to give people some sense of what you're interested in and what you've done over time, and the fact that I think that that what you've written, and certainly going back to that first book, I think it meant a lot to people and still does. I'm sure that there are still people, because it continues to be available. It's been updated. There have been different editions. But the book is still there, and I'm sure that there are people
still
who are
selling. Yeah. My dad, 1971, my dad was the only one that believed in it, and he certainly he knew a lot more than I did about the questions on people's hearts. And what really changed my mind was how many people were drawn to the same questions that I was. You know, how can we as individuals create the world that we want, and how do our individual choices influence that?
Mm-hmm. That, it seems to me, you know, think back to the time you were 27?
Mm-hmm. When it came out, I was 27.
You're 27 years old. It was 1971, and you were making these arguments that at the time, I'm sure some people thought, well, these were sort of the property of the counterculture, and it was just kind of a fringe perspective. And yet, if you look at where we are now and you look at the standard advice that we're getting, it to eat less animal protein, to eat more whole grains, there's growing interest in organic products. People are trying to support their regional and local producers. They're interested in knowing where food comes from. There are concerns about how it affects us. certainly lots of concerns about how it affects our health. All of those things that you were writing about back then, now 35 years ago, what that then were considered kind of fringe, now all of this is very much mainstream.
I agree. It's been quite phenomenal, especially in the last 10 years. That is when I've seen the enormous change and appreciation of what it really takes to be healthy. And my the way that I connect this to democracy, of course, which is the theme of my new book, Democracy's Edge, is that, you know, my hunch is that there's not one of us who would say, yes, I think the kind of food system we need in our country is one that is maximally inefficient in terms of how much water and reuse to produce it, actually is threatening our health today, where now 1 in 9 of every private health dollars is going toward diseases that are related to obesity, which is clearly related to our diet. And so for me, there's a strong connection between literacy as the emergent solution and the addressing this fundamental problem that we've turned our food system actually into one of the biggest threats to our health and the health of our planet.
Yeah. It seems that maybe one of the reasons that Diet for a Small Planet did make such an impression on people was, that they gravitated to it, was that it did give them an opportunity to do something in their individual lives,
yes,
just for themselves, but that had larger implications. You know, it was one of the, you know, everybody knows the old saying about think globally, act locally. Well, this was, people actually, I think, could see it as a way of saying, here's something I can do in my little individual life as I go from day to day that does have some kind of larger implications.
Yes, and this happy coincidence is that I discovered that, in fact, what's best for my body is also best for the earth in every dimension, and best for other people, too, from whether I'm talking about the threat to farm workers. Now, there are 10,000 to 20,000 poisonings each year in the United States to farm workers. So by choosing organic, that's a very specific choice I can make. That sends ripples back to the system that less pesticide, less threat to people who work the land. So I think that idea that in one bite, so to speak, we can do that which is best for others, for the earth, and for our own bodies and health and pleasure. Whoa, you know, that's quite a deal.
Mm-hmm. I know that you want to talk about Democracy's Edge, and I do too, but I'm just interested in hearing you talk a little bit about what you were thinking about back in 1971, and how it is that you decided to, you were so moved to be thinking about this particular issue about food production, that then led you down that road that eventually led to your producing the book. And was that something that in your own life at the time was something that was very important that you were thinking about?
It was an intuition. I was, as a young woman, I was a community organizer in very poor communities in Philadelphia. The woman I worked most closely with in the welfare rights movement there died of a heart attack in her 40s. And I was convinced that Lily, who I adored, I was convinced she died of poverty. And I didn't know how what I was doing really addressed the roots of her suffering and her early death. And so my intuition then, once I got to California, I was in a graduate program there, but my intuition was that if I could just understand why is there hunger in the world? I mean, after all, what does virtually every species do? You know, we feed ourselves, we feed our offspring, and we're supposed to be the brainiest species, and we had not figured out how everyone can eat, you know? I figured that if I could just understand why hunger, that most primal need not being met, then I could understand the roots of Lily's death, and I could orient my life toward root causes rather than just flailing about, you know, one act of charity here, one act of protest there, that ultimately is not satisfying. I think all human beings want to know that our lives have meaning, and the way to find that is to explore the root causes. What is the dynamic that is creating needless suffering in the world? And that question is what led me to food and has kept me going and kept always one eye and, you know, one part of me is still in the question about our food system. And my new book is not a departure from Diet for a Small Planet. In fact, one of the key chapters is exactly about food and very much building on Diet for a Small Planet.
Yeah. And I think, again, as I said at the beginning, one of the points, one of the key points that you made then, and at the time, I'm not sure that there were that many people who were making it. Now I think probably it's an idea that is much more widely accepted. That is, if you look at the problem of hunger around the world and you ask, why is it? It is not because somehow the world is not capable of producing enough food to feed as many people as there. It's not a production issue.
Right. No, more than 3,000 calories just in grain alone for all of every person on Earth every day. So there's enough food to make us all chubby.
Before you did Diet for a Small Planet, were you a vegetarian?
No. I grew up in Cowtown, Fort Worth, Texas. Drove by the stockyards. No, I grew up on a pretty standard American diet. Of course, I grew up during that era where the feedlot system was developed and then come to be taken for granted, as I point out in Diet for a Small Planet, that actually for eons, forever, human beings had used ruminants like cattle and livestock to transform low-grade things that we can't eat, like grass and waste products, low-grade protein or non-proteins, into high-grade meat. Now, we had then turned that around so that we had what I discovered, and the great light bulb went on for me when I realized that we are feeding 16 pounds of grain and soy to livestock in this system, to beef, to cattle in this system, to get 1 pound of steak back. And so that was the light bulb that went on when I realized that we are taking abundance and creating scarcity from it because of the givens of our economic system that excludes so many people who are not able to make effective demand in the market for what they need. So we have this illusion of cheap grain that we then feed to livestock in great quantity.
Hmm. Let me introduce again our guest, Frances Moore-Lepe. She's the author of 15 books, including that very first that a lot of people still have on their bookshelf, Diet for a Small Planet, published in 1971. She has received 17 honorary doctorates. She was the fourth American to receive the Right Livelihood Award, sometimes called the Alternative Nobel Prize. She's the co-founder of Food First, the American News Service, and the Small Planet Institute. If you're interested, by the way, in finding out about that, they have a website, smallplanetinstitute.org, and her most recent book is Democracy's Edge, the subtitle Choosing to Save Our Country by Bringing Democracy to Life, and it is published by Jossie Bass. And questions welcome here on the show if you'd like to talk with her. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. What does it mean when you use that phrase, democracy's edge? What does it mean to be at democracy's edge?
Well, it means that we are both the negative and the positive, that we are at the edge of losing the democracy that we've always thought we had, and I can explain more of that, but we also are pushing democracy forward. So the book is really about living in this time of contradiction where we are moving in two directions at once. Sometimes I joke and say, when I was a young person, I thought, well, things would get better or they would get worse, depending on whether people listen to me, right? And never could have imagined that I would grow up in a world in which things are getting both worse and better. And it is a time, therefore, of great choice. And so what I mean is we are at that edge where we can move forward or we can kind of go over the edge. And I think that what has happened in the great tragedy in our society today is that democracy has thinned to mean only elections plus a market economy, a particular kind of market driven by one rule, that is highest return to existing wealth, shareholders. And what happens then, you have such concentration of wealth, and I describe this in the book, that it ends up warping our political system. We now have 61 lobbyists in Washington for every one person that you and I have elected to represent us there. And so this is what I mean by being on the edge of losing democracy, because we've allowed such concentration of wealth that it warps and distorts the political process so that you and I, the citizens, lose our voices.
Mm-hmm. Well, that I think here we're getting to a central issue whenever we talk about the need for citizen activism, for people to be more involved in their communities and in making decisions that affect their communities and the country in a larger sense. And it's very difficult to get people to engage because they're so turned off by politics as they are. And particularly, I think they have this sense that their involvement doesn't matter, that there's nothing that they can do that's going to really change things. So even getting people to register and getting people to vote is getting to be difficult because people say, what difference does it make if I do that or not, much less be involved in some community organization or go to some kind of a town hall meeting on some subject or write a letter to their representative in Congress or anything. That seems to be even more trouble. It's very difficult to get people to engage because they feel like, what's the point?
Yes, I completely agree with you, and that's why I'm doing what I'm doing with my life. And the way that I wrote Democracy's Edge is through story. I believe we learn from each other's stories, and this is a book all about from the different dimensions of our lives, from food to politics and economics and the media and so on, where are people actually realizing their power to create the world they want? And I start with these big, sort of this big straitjacket, I use this metaphor of Thomas Jefferson, who said that, it would be silly to think that we should wear still this coat that fitted us as a boy now that we are, grown-ups. And so we're still wearing this constricting coat of misconceptions, and I take each one of these misfits, and one of them is precisely, sort of what I was getting at, that money is always going to control the system, and therefore, as you're suggesting, a lot of people think there's no place for me, the citizen. And so I tell stories about what is happening, invisible to most of us, at least a handful of states that are effectively making for clean elections that work. I talk about one of my heroines in the book is Marge Mead, a grandmother in Arizona who sort of fell into a League of Women Voters meeting, started taking notes, and she became a citizen leader in the movement for clean elections in that state that has already brought 25% increase in voter participation. And just this winter, we saw Connecticut pass, because of this grassroots efforts, a very significant clean elections law to get money out of the system. So I tell stories about how people are going to the very root of the problem that makes them feel so disempowered.
We have a caller here to bring into the conversation. Let's do that. Someone listening in Champaign County, here where we are. Line number one. Hello.
Yeah, good morning. I wanted to sort of be a little nostalgic in a way, I guess, and reminisce about my first reading of it. And what impressed me a lot in the book is something I haven't heard you speak about. Maybe you do tie it in. And I categorize it under the arrogance of the elite. The thing that I'm talking about it seems kind of mundane, but for a lot of people in the world, it's extremely important. And this was the idea that somehow native cultures perceive that rice and beans were synergistic. I mean, if you went to the textbooks of the time, they would tell you it doesn't matter what you eat with anything else as long as you get a good mix in your diet. And that's just, I think it's kind of commonplace that isn't true anymore, that combinations are important. And the fact that, these native cultures through the ages figured out that there was something good about combining these. Now we call it, the making up for the other amino acids. But at the time, I think it tied into maybe the feminist theory of Deirdre English and Barbara Ehrenreich about the betrayal of the Celtic culture and the woman knowledge and whatever you want to call it, and tying that all in together. You can tie in the colonial experience in Central and Mexico, Central America and Mexico, in that amaranth, which we now know you can buy at expensive costs at various places, health food concerns, but it was made illegal and immoral by the conquering Catholic Spaniards, and that it actually, you can sort of draw a line and say that this has caused protein deficiency through the centuries and decades. And it just seems to me that the arrogance of the elite, we know best kind of theory, which is totally antithetical to democracy, is kind of summoned, it's emblematic in these kind of examples. And I think I'll just hang up and let you react. I appreciate your efforts through the decades. Thank you.
All right.
What a brilliant statement. Yes, in fact, when I was a young woman, that in writing Diet for a Small Planet, precisely what the caller brought up was what so intrigued me, that yes, in Latin culture, the combination of grains, of corn and beans, or in India, the combination of lentils and rice, that that this was what our bodies could best use and created the most usable protein for the body, and yet they didn't have the laboratory to figure that out. It was through their own listening to their bodies and what worked best. And so, yes, that definitely was part of what I've continued to think about. And just in Africa, when my daughter Anna and I wrote our book Hope's Edge, and we were there in Kenya talking to women who were reclaiming their traditional foods, and told us that that of course they had traditionally grown the tubers, the root crops that could resist the drought that they were then experiencing, and that they grew various kinds of legumes that added protein to the diet. And yet when the colonial powers came in, they referred to those as the more or less the primitive crops. They really made them feel that this was somehow less valuable and introduced the colonial crops. And so this has been very much, I think, part of what I see now is living democracy emerging when people are reclaiming their traditional food wisdom and then building on it using modern science. And so when we were in the foothills of the Himalaya, my daughter and I, and talked to farmers there, they were letting go of the pesticide approach to agriculture. They were letting go of the imported seeds and returning to the seed sharing. And they were also developing their own research plots to continue to develop seeds that were good for them. And so I think there is a renewal in this appreciation of these traditional methods.
We are almost here at our midpoint already. Our guest is Frances Moore LaPay. If you're interested in calling in, you have questions, comments, they're certainly welcome. She's the author of 15 books, including that very first that we've talked about, Diet for a Small Planet, that was published in 1971 when she was 27 years old, and has since sold, I think, was it significantly over 3 million copies?
Yep, and it's still selling.
And it's still selling. And she has authored a number of other books, and this new one that has to do with citizen activism with reconnecting with the idea of democracy is Democracy's Edge, Choosing to Save Our Country by Bringing Democracy to Life. That is the subtitle. Jossie Bass is the publisher. She is the co-founder of Food First, the American News Service, the Small Planet Institute. They're on the web at smallplanetinstitute.org if you'd like to look into that. And questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. You know, one of the things that strikes me, I think one of the things that sometimes maybe alienates people from the idea of politics and political participation has something to do with the fact that the loudest voices are the people that are at the extremes of the political spectrum. And that it seems that what they're saying is that there's us and there's them, and that not only are them wrong, are evil, and if them take over, this country will be ruined. Now, it seems, though, that there are now a growing number of people that are saying that doesn't make sense. That's not going to get us anywhere. And instead of spending a lot of time arguing about what we disagree about, why don't we start thinking about what we agree about? And that then when that happens is that now people who maybe would identify themselves either as liberal or conservative, or maybe, you know, somewhere in the middle, would in fact say, well, wait a minute, there are a number of things that we actually do agree on, that we can agree on, so maybe we ought to start there. And that there seems to be this growing idea that there is a more in politics, that there is a more kind of productive middle, and that it would make more sense to see if you could figure out what that is than to cling on to those extremes, because that's really never going to get you any place.
Right. And in researching this book, I was so struck, so moved by how much common ground there is. So in the beginning of the book, I have a section on the myth of red versus blue, because actually 90% of us agree that corporations have too much power in Washington over decisions there. Two-thirds of us, both in red states and blue states, agree that we should basically do whatever's necessary to protect the environment. We get it, you know, that's our survival. We agree that universal health care should be something that, you know, is, in fact, you know, available to all of us. There is so much we do agree on, and I think that then what that leads me to conclude is that if we agree on so much, then why isn't the country moving that way? And my answer is that we are not truly represented in Washington, that money speaks louder than we citizens do. And therefore, the kind of people that I mentioned earlier, my hero, Marge Mead in Arizona, who's working on, who has succeeded, among, of course, many others there, in affecting clean elections, this is the direction that we have to go to get money out of the system and to get our voices into the system. So I think the answer, is both, that we have to be instead of just saying, oh, well, the loudest voices and the most nasty, the ones who will berate others and attack others as evil, they're the ones who get heard. Well, if the more reasoned voices aren't there, then of course those will rise to the top. So how do we engage? And so I've been really intrigued with this idea of democracy as an art, if you will. Democracy as a set of skills of engagement that, sure, if we don't know how to do it well, then it's not much fun. It's just like playing tennis. You know, when I tried and running around the court after the balls, it's not much fun. You know, it is fun if you know how to do it. And so how do we learn the arts of democracy? And on our website, smallplanetinstitute.org, if you go to the Democracy's Edge piece of that site, there's a handbook that I've created that goes over some of the basic skills that people are learning and finding so much satisfaction in learning how to do public engagement well so that you are building community and not dividing people.
Yeah. I have a number of callers here, and I promise I'll get to them in just a second. There's just one other thing I'm interested in having you reflect on, and that's the thing that concerns me, that we seem to have, as a society, we seem to have lost the notion of the public good, that is, if we ever had such a notion, and that I'm not sure how you go about recultivating an idea like that.
Well, I'm not so sure. I still think, and I know that there's research that shows that most people vote according to what they think is best for the society rather than simply their own narrow interest. I mean, that may surprise you, but I've seen research that points in that direction. For example, when I was canvassing door-to-door in Iowa during the last election, and there were elderly people who told me they were voting Republican because of the questions about gay marriage, for example, that wasn't... Clearly, their own personal self-interest wasn't, you know, how could that, you know, you would think they would be voting on the price of more pharmaceuticals, right? But they thought that that was an issue that, or they had been persuaded that that was an issue that mattered for the health of our overall society. So I think that that's what people struggle to figure out. The problem is, I feel that our public conversation is so warped by the influence, again, I hope I don't sound like a broken record here, but it's so influenced first of all, that wealth has become so concentrated and that it has so warped our political system that the voices of all of us thinking together about what is best for all of us just aren't reaching the surface, so most of us feel engaged in that conversation toward the common good.
Hmm. Well, let's talk with some other folks who are listening. And next in line is someone in Indiana on our line 4. Hello.
Hello. Basically, I called to thank her for her effort and being at the forefront of a lot of this stuff and getting things going. And also that she's a woman doing these things, which is important for role models for these young girls coming up. I have just one little question that may be important or not. If not, fine. When you talk about doing research, I wonder if you get involved in how the question is asked. And repeatedly in the big boys in the news, they talk about if we ask it this way, it goes that way. If we ask it this way, it goes that way. And I brought that up when you talked about the people thinking what's good for the country and the corporations. It's a different thing what they want for the country, though generally they're thinking about the country. Where does it break down where we sort of get zipped, and where does the Supreme Court fit in all this in terms of money going to politicians? So far they are not real interested in stopping the big funds, that's for sure. Thanks a lot. Another excellent show, David.
Well, thank you. Well, you can take on any
wow,
of
a lot of things there. Thank you for your encouragement. Yes, of course, how one asks the question. And in my own research, I try to read as broadly and get as much input as from different sources and read people I disagree with. But however you look at it, I think that there is, going back to the question that you raised, there is a lot of common ground on which we can build. It's just that those voices don't have much opportunity to engage. As far as the Supreme Court, I think this is a huge issue because the court has continued to say basically that the right to spend and the right to speak are the same, and that I profoundly disagree with. And if the court takes that position that the right to speak and the right to spend are the same, then they will continue to block many of the campaign finance reforms. For example, the Vermont court, the Vermont approach was challenged by the Supreme Court. So I think that that fundamental question of who sits on the court, of course, is in part goes back to then who we elect to represent us and who is influencing those folks. And so it still comes back to whether or not you and I, as ordinary citizens, can find a place for ourselves in the public debate. Yes, in voting, but beyond voting. And just to pick an example that I've been moved by just in the last couple of days that fits so much into Democracy's Edge, where I talk about participatory budgeting and participatory planning at the city level, I just read a very interesting article in Shelter Force magazine about a town near here, Lawrence, where regular folks come together and have a direct say in the allocation of the city dollars and have made significant improvements. And this is something that is now happening in 300 Brazilian cities where some of the poorest people are involved. And the result is that the city expenditures are going more toward the benefit of the vast majority who are poor instead of just into the wealthier areas. So I think that we will build our confidence to be able to stand up toward the kinds of decisions that ultimately come down, such as those in the Supreme Court, only as we ourselves engage and gain that kind of confidence in our own voices.
Let's go on. We'll talk with someone next in Champaign, line one. Hello.
Yeah, in terms of comment, your voice still sounds like you're 27. And as a compliment. Actually, the issue of rice, which is a very sad commentary, white rice, and I know part of it, I have a friend who's from China, and the thing is that it was more prestigious to have white rice and all the things that you're missing by not, you know, with the brown rice. So you can make a comment on that, but great show.
Well, I would like to jump from that. Yes, that's unfortunate. You know, I go into restaurants all the time in Boston and ask for brown rice and rarely get it. But I think that that whole question of processing is a critical one, because what happens, as the caller notes, that when you remove the brown, what makes it brown, you remove the nutrients with it, and it has longer shelf life. And so this brings me back to the fundamental question of how are we creating this food industry in this country that is actually a threat to our health. It's because in Diet for a Small Planet there is a chapter called Who Asked for Fruit Loops, and I asked the reader to imagine that he or she is the chief executive officer of a major food company, and your only concern is bringing the highest return to your shareholder. If that's your only concern, then you can predict everything that's happened to our food. You take out the germ and the bran out of the grain, which is what the caller is referring to with white rice, and that's where the nutrients are, so you degrade it. You add the trans fats, for example, which we know are not good for us, but they're very cheap, so you save money. You add the high fructose corn syrup, which is not good for us, but it's very cheap because it's made from corn. And you add the sugar and salt, which can be highly addictive for a lot of us. And there you have it. There you have the diet that is now a threat to our health and responsible for one out of every nine private health dollars going to treat obesity-related diseases. So I think this question of food processing also comes down to the logic Yes, historically. I'm not saying it's all from the logic of the food industry today, but the caller's question raises this fundamental crisis for our country that processed food is literally killing us. And so that's why I think that a whole foods diet, locally produced, fairly produced, and organic is both best for our bodies and the earth.
All right. Let's talk with someone in Belgium, community nearby us, line number two. Hello.
Good morning. I'd like to point out the fact that as the last two national political elections have shown us, that we truly do not have democracy as long as we have an electoral college that makes up its own mind and is also influenced by the Supreme Court, which was packed by the individual's father, who we still have to represent us, and is doing a terrible job of representing us in the world. And it's really sad that we don't have the democracy that we wished we had. And where do we go to get rid of this electoral college that's really causing these problems, that don't allow us to have the democracy that we really wish we had?
Well, Ms. LaPay, you have a thought about that?
On the electoral college, well, I think that many people agree, and it's something that I haven't personally focused on, but I do think whether it's the changing the system to eliminate the electoral college or any other of these huge questions facing us, that it does come back to getting our voices back in the process of making those decisions. And here I would like to say that we have been warned about our current condition by many great leaders, and one particularly eloquent is Franklin Delano Roosevelt. And I just discovered this speech that he gave in 1938. So we've been warned about this process. 1938 in April, he said, quote, "The liberty of democracy is not safe if we tolerate the growth in private power to the point where it is stronger than the democratic state itself. That, in its essence, is fascism."
I have to agree 100%. And because the Electoral College will never get a third party that will allow us to represent ourselves in a more diverse manner. Two parties are just not diversity. That's black against white, A against B, mm-hmm. however you want to put it. And thank you very much.
I think it's very interesting that not one of the new democracies being formed over the last several decades has chosen our system. That should say something. And one of the things I'm excited about and wrote about in Democracy's Edge, and am helping in a small way to happen here in Massachusetts, is to allow third parties to have what is called cross-endorsement voting, so that it gives a better chance for a third party to develop without running the risk of wasting people feeling like they're wasting votes or having a spoiler phenomenon. It's called cross-endorsement. It's really something worth looking into. In New York State, it's made a huge difference with the Working Families Party that is already influenced. In only 8 years, has influenced such matters as a higher minimum wage in New York that has brought a great improvement for a million people in that state. So I would like the listeners to remember that term. It's a little tricky to explain briefly, but cross-endorsement voting and the Working Families Party, I think, is a model that can help us move beyond this two-party lockdown.
Yeah, that was. I'm glad that the caller raised that issue, because that was something that I wanted to raise myself. That I think a lot of people feel that as long as we have the two parties controlling the way that campaigns are run and the way that elections are run, they're not going to do anything to jeopardize their domination of the system. And that's why they have orchestrated the rules so that it makes it extremely difficult to have a third party.
Yes, and this cross-endorsement approach was legal in most states 100 years ago. And so there is precedent for it. And now I believe it's in about 7 states, and we're about to vote on it here in Massachusetts, so that it's a way that third parties can form, again, and allow people to vote on their ballot line for a major party candidate, but still signify that they are loyal to the values and representing the values of that third party as it gains strength of its own to run its own candidates. So it's a very powerful tool to break out of this straitjacket.
We have about 10 minutes left on the program. Our guest is Frances Moore LaPay. She is the author of a number of books and probably continues to be best known for her very first, Diet for a Small Planet, published in 1971. She has received a number of honorary doctorates. She was the fourth American to receive the Right Livelihood Award, which is sometimes called the Alternative Nobel Prize. She's co-founder of Food First, of the American News Service, and the Small Planet Institute. Her most recent book, the one that deals with the subject that mostly we've been talking about here, that is about citizen activism, about getting people involved once again in politics and in making democracy. Her book is titled Democracy's Edge, Choosing to Save Our Country by Bringing Democracy to Life. Jossie Bass is the publisher. We have some other people here who would like to talk with us, and we'll get right to them. The next caller is in Savoy, and that's line 3. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Did I hear you say that you worked with the Welfare Rights Organization in Philadelphia in the 70s?
In the 60s.
Oh, the 60s. Okay. All right. Well, I was there in the 70s working for the Philadelphia County Board of Assistants and worked with welfare rights folks. But my question is, my teenage son has moved from being a vegetarian to now he wants to be a vegan. And because he's a teenager, of course, he won't listen to anything that I have to say. But I was wondering if you had some advice or places that I could direct him. He's fairly sloppy about his diet.
Mm.
And I wanted to be able to... You know, I'm fully supportive of this, but I would like him to be able to select foods which are helpful and good for him. And I know that there are certain combinations. I read your book, but it was probably in 1972. But I was wondering if you had any suggestions or places to direct him for, you know, thoughtful approaches to his diet. And I'll hang up and listen. Thank you.
All right.
Well, I sure hope that Diet for a Small Planet would still be relevant for him and appeal. I think that for all of us, but certainly a vegan diet, that making every bite count, you know, eating in the plant world, but whole foods, not processed, eating locally, therefore you get fresher food, so more of those nutrients are available to you, organic, so that you're not consuming pesticides, and eating in the whole range of plant world, that means the legumes, which are so rich in protein, nuts, which are also rich in protein, and seeds, and combining those with all the rich grains that are available now. And an earlier caller mentioned amaranth, which is very, very nutritious. My favorite recent habit is quinoa, which is Q-U-I-N-O-A, and it is really quick cooking. It's almost like an instant food, high-protein grain that is very light and just makes wonderful, put some curried beans and vegetables over that, and it's just fabulous. So I think just combining the grain world and this nuts and seeds and beans and lentils world, that where the protein is in general in the plant world, and eating fresh and eating local, and you will have a very healthy son, probably healthier than yourself, so not to worry.
All right, let's go to another caller here. This is Champagne, and it's line 1. Hello.
Hi, Ms. LaPay. Thanks for taking my call this morning. The Vegetarian Resource Group is also a wonderful place to get good information about vegan diet and things like that. I wondered if you would talk a little bit about the importance of local food as contrasted to organic food, and then about ways that we can legislate the use of local food in politically funded organizations like state university food services. Thank you very much, and I'll hang up and listen.
Yes, well, I know in, I believe it's Sioux City area in Iowa, there is now legislation that, or some ordinance, I should say, that encourages, if not mandates, local provisioning of major institutions, and this is a movement that is catching on around the country. Localharvest.org is a great way to find where local food can be purchased in your area, localharvest.org, and the Community Food Security Coalition is a great group helping make these connections. And the local, for me, is all about, in part, it's about fairness and the environment, in the sense that we need to recreate family farm agriculture here, which is proven to be the most effective and the most the most efficient and most fair food system that is now being eroded by increasing corporate concentration in the food industry. So buying local, that means to me buying from local and organic farmers, because again, we're not only preventing the pesticides from entering our bodies, but we're limiting that threat or eliminating that threat to farm workers. I mentioned 10 to 15,000 poisonings per year among farm workers who now have a life expectancy no higher than people living in Africa. So that's very alarming. So I think both are important. And one of the stories that we tell in Hope's Edge, the book I wrote with my daughter, is such a great example of what can be done here. The fourth largest city in Brazil declared good food a human right, and they started, the city facilitated small local farmers having produce stands in the inner city that could sell to the poorest people there, keeping the prices quite accessible. And everybody benefited because the local farmers got such a great market for their food. And school gardens is another important piece of this, as well as farmers markets and community gardens, all of which are growing at a very rapid clip right now.
Yeah. It's interesting. It seems to me that maybe more than ever, though, that people really have to educate themselves about food. They have to think carefully. They have to ask questions. They have to look carefully at what they're buying. And at the same time, I think it gets to be difficult because now food manufacturers and processors understand that people are thinking about these things. And so if you say something that is organic, there are people who will buy it and there are people who will pay a premium for it. At the same time, you have to ask yourself, well, what does that mean exactly? A couple of weeks ago, I had a conversation with Michael Pollan, who's written this very interesting new book that he titles The Omnivore's Dilemma, where he looks at the industrial system of food production that we have in this country. And he said something like, well, you know, you can have an organic factory farm. So that, you know, that you'd have to ask, well, what is it? What exactly does it mean, for example, that something is organic?
I really appreciate Michael Pollan's work, but that shouldn't. I mean, there are many different pieces of this that we can be working on simultaneously, and organic is one part of it. You can't solve the factory farm issue, which is a whole other issue of the industrial agriculture debacle, just with one tactic. Certainly. You know, that can't be solved at that level. That's a whole other question having to do with all sorts of policies that are subsidizing big agribusiness. And back to this question of their role in political decision-making. But I would just say that for me, that we do now have pretty decent standards for organic agriculture. And so that when it is certified organic, it means that you are making a very powerful statement that ripples back throughout the system that does prevent that pesticides from entering our food system and harming, as I keep mentioning, the farmers and farm workers as well as our own bodies. So it is a very, very important statement. And just because it doesn't alone deal with industrial agriculture doesn't mean that it's not important to do. Mm-hmm. And then to deal with industrial agriculture, we have to be removing these subsidies that we're paying now that is encouraging that system. And for example, in the Midwest, in Minnesota, I've been following this effort by the big agribusiness operations there to remove the rights, the democratic rights of townships to say no to these big hog and dairy operations that are polluting their environment. And so that's a fundamental democracy question that we have to connect to at the level of democratic rights to stand up for what is healthy for our communities.
Let's talk with someone in Chicago, line number 4. Hello.
In developing a democracy, some people in another country say, oh, we want to create a constitution. And somebody jokingly says, well, why don't you use ours? We're not using it. That was in a Woody Allen movie recently. In a batch of vegetable soup, it's not right for the carrot to say, I taste better than the peas, or the peas to say, I taste better than the cabbage. It takes all the vegetables to make a good soup. Somehow or other, we've got a mix on a religion that says this religion's better than that one, and another one is better than that one. So we've got to get to realize that they all have their own flavor and characteristics and quality. So enjoy the good things while they're there, rather than ruin them. And thank you. Bye-bye.
All right. Well, that's a pretty good metaphor.
I like that.
We're kind of coming down to the end of the time. Maybe we have a couple of minutes left. And I would certainly expect that because you've been doing what you have been doing now for such a long time, you would have to say that you were an optimist. That is, you're optimistic about the... Oh, no? You're not?
I'm a possibilist, David. And that is very different. I think anything is possible, and I think we've never been here before. We humans have never been so able to look over the edge, as I say in Democracy's Edge. We can now see catastrophe in a way that no other culture that's gone under, you may be familiar with that book, Collapse, where, you know, people, you know, cut down the last tree, and you think, well, what were they thinking? Well, hopefully now we can see that the path that we are on is leading directly to global catastrophe. And therefore, I think anything is possible in terms of the kind of turning that we can make to become problem solvers. And the way I end Democracy's Edge is I say that, look, none of the things, that amazing things that I've just written about, that you've just read about, would I have given much chance at all when I was my children's age. It's not possible to know what's possible. And therein lies our freedom.
So now I'm struck by what you just said about how maybe even when you were 27 years old, you would not have thought we could have achieved what even we've achieved to this point.
Well, in some ways, yes, and certainly in big questions that I've written about. For example, just to give you one little story on me and my E of Little Faith moment, is I was in Wisconsin in the 80s, late 80s, and met these very well-meaning kind of, you know, just good old, you know, good folks, dairy farmers who were going to create a cooperative, an organic dairy cooperative. And I thought, oh, isn't that sweet? You know, I had a kind of paternalistic attitude about it. And I thought, yeah, well, that would be nice, and it might help a few people in western Wisconsin. Well, I'm now talking about Organic Valley, which is 750 farm families all across the country. I can buy it in my local store here in Boston, and it's been a fabulous success that is returning wealth back to rural communities, that is keeping the organic standard, and that is democratic. The farmers have a say. And I would not have given that much of a chance. That's what I'm saying. And therefore, I'm trying to learn to be what I call bold humility is what I call it.
Yeah, we got to leave it there. I want to thank you very much for talking with us. We certainly appreciate it.
My great pleasure, David.
Frances Moore LePay. The new book is Democracy's Edge. It's published by Jossie Pass. And you've been listening to a program from the Focus 580 Archives, a show first broadcast August 4th of 2006.